June 1st with Harry's Rifle.
And this is mainly just so when I get home, I pull out the good stuff and write it up as necessary.
That's where I take notes.
Yeah. And actually, that's... Okay. I talked with Hank DeHaven yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah.
He was on my shift for a while.
Yeah.
But he just started.
Do you ever go to the breakfast that they have?
No, I don't. Yeah. I get the letters from all the time.
Yeah. And I guess that was one of my questions was, you were in health instruments?
Oh, no.
Ever? Ever?
No.
Okay.
Never.
I thought I heard your name associated with that. Maybe
operations and engineering.
Okay. Okay. I was hoping somebody could tell me what a cutie pie was.
Small, like a pistol. And mainly low level. Soft, beta, and alpha, I think. But there's a lot of people can tell you more about
that. Yeah. You don't know the real name for it, though. They call it a CP or a cutie pie.
PewDiePie.
What CP stand for? Yeah. I haven't been able to find that out yet.
Don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Nobody does.
Yeah.
Okay. So you went to Chicago in
1942.
We were married in 1943.
Well, we were married when we moved to Chicago.
One day early in 1944, I received a call from my head office, and the superintendent told me that effective Friday, I was transferred on loan to the University of Chicago.
That's
right.
That's
all right.
Doc Thurston,
okay.
Yeah.
Early 1944.
I said, what am I going to do, Doc? He said, I don't know. They'll tell you when you get there. That's what it was.
Yeah. And when you got there, you were doing, this is the part I wanted to ask you about. I was following the construction of the B reactor. My particular responsibility was what they called the Belfield valves.
Oh, Belfield. But that's at the reactor. That's not in Chicago.
Oh, it wasn't?
No.
I was following the construction of the B reactor.
Yeah, but that was, that's when we were out. That's a construction of B reactor.
And so, okay. I thought you got out there after B was built. No, B was in the process of being built when you got there. You mentioned they were laying up the graphite when you got there.
So they were doing that. They're getting close to the end of that, and that's why I was. See, the Belfield valves were up on the top of the reactor, and they were the automatic valves that would be actuated in case of a scram, and would dump the boron solution right into the VSR's thimbles.
They were the very last ditch. Once used,
third safety.
It would basically wreck the reactor, right?
We'd have to take the whole thimble out, and if they had any holes in it, then the boron would get into the graphite.
So those were into the safety rods thimbles.
That's right.
So the thimbles were basically...
You don't call it that's right, the VSRs.
Mm-hmm. The VSRs would have gone down already?
If you had a scram, they would.
And then around them there was space to dump the liquid in.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you see, the thing is, what if the VSRs didn't go in?
Oh, if there was a problem with them.
Yeah, that's right.
Boom.
That was right in the same circuitry that would indicate the rods were in. If they weren't in, the Belfield valves would open and dump the stuff in.
Would that have happened automatically?
Yeah.
Yeah?
If the VSRs didn't go in. Because you wouldn't want the VSRs to go in unless you wanted to shut down now.
Right. And as far as you know, they never actually had to do that?
No, they didn't.
Yeah. They never really had a real life there.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why we went to the Pulse Reacts eventually.
Because it was easier to get it out afterwards?
So they got ball bearings.
Right.
And we could always vacuum those out.
What was the plan to get out the liquid if you needed to?
I don't think we had any.
Yeah. It sure beats losing the reactor.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, you know, if worse come to worse and the thimbles didn't leak, we could always suck it out with a hose and pump. Of course, it'd be hotter in hell, too.
The liquid would have been.
Yeah.
Because it absorbed all those neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, since you were there during construction, what kind of stuff were you involved with while it was being finished up?
Well, we all wandered around, you know. Until we got close to startup, we weren't assigned specific tasks. That's when I got the Bellfield valves. And
during that period?
Yeah.
You were helping to design the way they were built or the way they went in? Or
No. It was just to check the operation and how they were built, to get some idea of some feeling of safety that they were going to work. In other words, we'd time them and all sorts of things, you know.
Okay. But you were getting ready for operation.
Oh, yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, we weren't far from it then.
Any involvement with the reactor during construction other than familiarizing yourself with it, getting involved?
Mainly that was it, yeah.
Okay.
You might get a one day assignment. Hey, go today and do this or that and look at the safety rods on the side, you know,
okay.
or look at the X level and see how they were doing and so on.
What was your clearance that you could see all that stuff?
Well, that was interesting. My clearance at the University of Chicago was top. I got out here and they wouldn't let me look at my own notebooks.
Right.
But we did have it. They called it Q.
And that was the highest or close to the highest?
But, well,
for normal persons?
Yeah, that's right. All of us operation. Even those the supervision, we didn't have the right to a lot of documents.
Yeah, because was it Hank DeHaven said he had a U? Is there a U
well,
clearance?
Now, Hank came in after we were just about started all the reactors,
right.
And that sounds, I don't know what the monitors had, you know?
But they were pretty free to go anywhere
they had to,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
If we didn't go anywhere without them, and, well, we weren't supposed to, but
right.
Every now and then, if the need occurred, we did.
But as an operator, you were pretty much available to look at any part of the reactor?
Yeah, I was, and then you'll see it. I was to start as a shift supervisor in what they called patrol.
Yeah, why'd they call it that?
Because we patrolled the building.
As opposed to sitting in the...
Looking for anything, you know. But, actually, we carried one of those big, heavy Beckmans with us. We all said our right arms were a little bit longer.
Right.
And we went everywhere, and you noted any radioactivity that you met
right there
in all these days, yeah.
Yeah. Some of it was just normal background.
That's
or
right,
thing,
yeah.
And other places.
And some of it was supposed to be clean, you know.
Yeah.
For example, we would go in, boy, I'll tell you, after all these years, my memory's starting to slip too. But above the VSRs, that's the electric motors and so on
right
there. And we'd go up the rear stairwells, across the top, down the stairs to the top of the reactor, and then over and down the stairs on the near side. And the only place we got anything really was when you start down on the top of the reactor, and there was a little shine, not much.
Huh.
We had 2x4 barricades around the actual rods.
Because were the thimbles just opened up into the core?
The thimbles, oh yeah, the thimbles, well of course, you know, they, a thimble being closed, but they went right down to about, just below the last row of active tubes.
Okay. Thimbles were closed at the top?
No, at the bottom. They were open
right
at the top.
But otherwise, that was straight down.
Straight down in, that's correct.
Okay. And there must have been a lot of hot air coming out of there, or at least it was warm.
If you would get something out of there, but it was, the ventilation was pretty good.
Yeah.
It sucked it up pretty good. And I can't ever, well, I don't remember ever getting anything significant up there.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about how that was, because everything else was kind of closed and sealed
right
up.
Mm-hmm.
But theoretically, the thimbles were solid. If they didn't have a leak, there was no helium getting out or anything
right
like
that's
that.
That's right. there'd be, you know, whatever it was in there, it could get a little irradiated. But there again, everything, as long as you didn't get a lot of dust and stuff in the air didn't accept much radioactivity.
The vertical safety rods were solid when they first...
The rod themselves?
Yeah, one long piece.
Yeah, well, but they weren't long. They were in sections. They were actually screwed together.
Huh.
Oh, now let's see.
But it behaved like a long rod.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Later on, somebody mentioned they might have put hinges in them of some sort. Does that ring a bell?
No.
Okay.
Never. Because even when we took them out, I went into engineering then after a while. And one of the big projects that we had that was really tough was removing the rod so we could get the thimble, replace the thimbles.
I've heard of that.
And that was a bitch.
And
those rods were hot.
Yeah. And what did I hear? They had to cut a hole in the cement wall above the reactor.
They had that
and sneak them out.
Long chute down to the truck. And we taped it. We designed a taping device that as the rod was pulled out, it went like this and taped it all the way down to the bottom, and thereby containing any of the solids that would be on the rod.
Right.
That was hot.
But weren't the rods normally out of the reactor?
Yes, except when you shut down.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why they weren't all that hot.
Okay.
But
the control rods were probably a lot hotter.
Oh yeah.
Because they were in so much.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because we moved those in and out to control the heat of the reactor where we put it.
Okay. You said that they were taking apart Fermi's main pile, the CP1
yeah.
or CP2, one of those.
I don't know what they called
yeah.
it. It was the only one there. So Fermi's other reactors were up in another site.
At that point?
Yeah.
At the Argonne?
Argonne,
they already,
yeah.
They already built
yeah.
the building. Okay. And did you see it?
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You got to peek in the door?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Watch Marsden and Digner and Fermi.
Here you are.
He was a great guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I really admired him.
There's some people who might be as smart as a lot of other people, but they have something else that allows them to get along with other people,
to explain
what they're doing,
and
give confidence.
Him. That was him.
Yeah.
Give you an example. It may be in there. When we first got there, all the big people, head of the radiation monitoring and Fermi and all, and Site B where they made the slugs, you know, and so on, yeah, they all talk and they'd stand up at the rostrum and speak very nice, but just formal. Fermi came in and he sat on the table, dangled his feet over the edge. He always played with a little stub of a pencil like this, played with his ear. And he said he was going on, we have people here doing this and people here doing that. He said, I got them all over. I don't know what they're doing. That was, you know, that's a pretty big man.
Yeah. Considering he was involved in one of the biggest projects of the century.
That's right.
When you look in the squash court where they had the pile set up, did it look at all like a lab?
Oh, no.
Yeah?
Now we had two more down below, and that's where we did the Semmelwerks. And this was the one there, and it's just a big squash pit. You know what they look
yeah.
like? Big pile of carbon in the center. Ropes hanging out for the rods and stuff, but they were gone by that time.
Yeah. Didn't have instruments on every wall of the room?
No, they were all gone. Whatever they had then was gone.
Okay. I guess there wasn't any problem so much with residual radiation since there never had been much.
No, that wasn't bad at all. Even our Semmelwerks wasn't all that bad.
And I think you said in here that you were dealing with separations?
Yeah.
The chemistry and the...
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And that was... didn't need to be done the day the reactor was done, but they wanted to have the process nailed down, I guess.
Well, that's right. That was We had a couple people, and, you know, that was microchemistry. The whole thing was developed from not much. And that was done in New Chem, which was a block away from the West Stands. And I carried some of the first plutonium over to fellows at Alpaw and Seaboard. Those guys there.
And where did you guys get it from?
Well, we actually had assemblers. We got Clinton slugs.
Okay.
So we dissolved them and ran them through whatever preparation the microchemists would tell us they wanted to try. And then we would bring that little sample over to them, patrolmen on each side, carrying a little lead pig like this.
And you're talking like?
Well, it's a test tube.
Oh, really? Oh, so you're getting good quantities at that point, as opposed to teaspoons or...
Well, you know, it was diluted. It might be full of plutonium nitrate.
Okay.
But
okay. The
plutonium would be very little.
Okay. Yeah. And that's because they got the Clinton thing going up early.
That's right.
As far as it as a semi-works, somebody else who I had read said it never fulfilled its real job as a semi-works because... A, it wasn't done before, it was not barely done before B reactor was already getting built. And in a perfect world, they would have waited a few years.
Yeah, but it was done way before you needed it at B plant, at 221B.
For the separations
part.
That's
right.
Okay. And they were able to use the plutonium.
That's what we were doing, and Alba and those boys developed the separations used in 221B.
Okay. So you needed a source of plutonium, and that was one way to get it. And they also learned a lot about B reactor, how to build B reactor from putting Clinton together.
I think so.
I think in a perfect world, there would have been about 10 years in between each of
those. Oh, right. Now you're going back to Clinton. I don't know. Now, let's see. Fellas left from Kankakee for Oak Ridge about 3 or 4 months before I went to Chicago. Maybe a little bit. No, that's about all. Six at the outside, because some of the guys I lived with went down there. Roy Mahan, Walt Winsheimer, and any number of other ones.
Okay. So in that sense, Clinton was serving both purposes then.
We wouldn't have had the slugs.
Yeah.
We had no place to irradiate them if they didn't.
How many slugs do you think you would ever deal with in a given period of time? Hundreds or just a few?
Oh, no. No. As I remember, there weren't more than a dozen slugs, the little ones that we put in the dissolver per batch.
Okay. And did you do dozens and dozens of various batches or just a few?
Well, I would say we almost ran one a week. We ran the people from New Chem, Microchem. They were ahead of what we could do. You know, they had the next. They had all
the process.
Yeah.
Okay.
They were had not do this. They knew what they were going to do in the next several runs, and we had to wait. You know, you didn't get them out of Clinton's reactor and ship them all the way to Hanford, to Chicago, very often.
Yeah.
And I really, when you get around to it, first I saw them was when they came in a cask and in the squash cords. And that's the semi-works I'm talking about. You understand that?
Yeah.
And it seems to me like one a week, 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Get that many.
And how hot were those slugs compared to what they ended up producing at B reactor? Did they have to be cooked nearly as long?
No,
right?
No. I don't know how many megawatt days they were cooked at, but nothing like the Hanfords. And nowhere the size. You know, they were only 4-inch slugs and about like that.
Oh, okay.
So we could take them out of a bucket, a pair of tongs, and drop them in the dissolver.
Or at Hanford, if you got within 20 feet of one, you were...
In Hanford, well, they were the dissolver at Hanford was about 20 feet down, and cover blocks about 6 foot thick, and we could do it all remotely.
Yeah. So you were getting out just tiny bits of plutonium, but enough to verify that the progress was working.
They were satisfied with it.
Yeah.
They would like more, but they could do it.
Yeah. That's the thing that impresses me about this whole process.
I think that's one of the things that is overlooked.
Yeah.
the job that those chemists did on.
People say it was an easier job because it was, quote, just chemistry, but it was all brand new and
how do you even handle it? You know, is this a tenth of a drop, and you try to run the precipitate it, and filter it, and that sort of thing, dry it.
So had you been in chemistry before then?
I was a chemical engineer.
Chemical engineer, which was just right for the job then. Yeah.
Yeah. See, I was in TNT at Kankakee.
Mm-hmm. Was that the actual name of it, or was that
what?
The Kankakee? TNT abbreviation?
No, trinitrotoluene.
It was the name. Okay, it wasn't an acronym for something else.
No,
it was
trinitrotoluene.
Okay. Yeah, I think that was in here.
As you say, when you're all done, if you give me a write-up, and if you want, I'll go over it and look check
it
for you.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Because actually, so being in operations, you were someone who knew an awful lot about the plant. Although you did mention that you never went over to the water plant, you tended not to go into other buildings.
Not too much, yeah. No. Well, the reactor building was, as you know, the only time we went out was we go to lunch, which was about 100 yards away, because they didn't want us eating in there, you know.
Right.
For a long time, they were very critical of that. And the power people would come over to the valve pit, but they didn't get up in the work area too much either.
Okay. When you went out to eat outside the building, was it outside the exclusion area too?
That's right.
Through the gate?
Yeah, through the gate.
Okay.
And we only went to the lunchroom in case we were needed, you know.
Say that again? You only went where?
We only went, when we left the reactors, we only went to the lunchroom.
Okay.
I have sent people to first aid occasionally, so.
Yeah. Okay. Because as far as you were concerned, you needed water coming into the reactor, but you didn't care what they were doing over there. It wasn't your...
Yeah, well, we had limits, because you see, if the water wasn't as pure as it was supposed to be, then the effluent to the river, to the 107,
right,
would be high.
Right.
And really, if it got so high, and it never did for me, then you're supposed to shut down.
Be a problem.
It could be.
Who was it? What department was monitoring the effluent?
We were.
We had the
monitors right at the beginning of 107, and then on the outlet of 107, because that was going right to the river.
Okay.
Not going in too much, well.
Yeah. No. It's. I can tie these things together with other parts later.
All right.
But you weren't, you didn't know what the clarity of the water coming in. All you could say was, gee, we're getting really high readings going out. Maybe it's because the water's not clear?
Well, it's a matter of ions or two, you know. I don't remember, Gene, that we did. They were supposed to do such and such, and as long as it was not building up too much, then we didn't bother with them, you know.
Right.
As long as enough of it and the right pressure.
Kept things going, yeah. Okay, I guess this is when you were talking about being on patrol.
Yeah.
Carrying the Beckmans, 35 pounds. We'd go around the building checking to make sure that there were no leaks and no stray radiation.
Yeah.
Patrol. That was one of the jobs the patrol people did in combining with the radiation monitoring experts.
And
what was the two aspects?
Well, you know, we weren't experts in radiation.
Right.
And we would see a reading and so on, but was it beta, was it alpha? We knew it wasn't alpha because we didn't have much to read alpha.
Right.
But the radiation monitors, we counted on them to keep things safe. And if they would, I'm sure that they read our patrol readings. And they might have gone checked. I really...
Okay.
You know, one thing, we were pretty well compartmentalized. We ran our own business and, okay, you tell me what you did and I'll be all right, you know.
Right, right. But at the time, there were health monitoring people who were doing similar things to you, but usually in accordance with somebody being with them, somebody needing to go somewhere.
Yeah, or a special job, you know.
Right.
They would set up a time limit for doing this. You understand that?
Right. And that you wouldn't have anything to do with that.
Except gripe, kept gripe about it, you know, because they always were cutting us too sharp, we said.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it was for your own good.
Sure it was. We knew that, too.
Now, I was likening it to, you know, a health inspector in a restaurant is protecting the customers.
Right. It's the same.
But in your job, he's protecting the kitchen help.
Yeah.
He's protecting the people in the kitchen.
That's right.
So, in that sense, yeah, you can only complain so loudly, and then it's like, what do you want me to do? Leave you, let you go do it?
Yeah, well, yes, we do.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there was another aspect to that, too, the patrol and the monitoring. What is it, and where, how's it getting here, you know?
Right. It wasn't always obvious if it was a leak.
No.
They were saying that sometimes during recharging, helium would be coming out in small amounts.
Helium leaks were the bane of our existence, and they were so hard to find and hard to fix.
Never dyed the helium so it would show up if it leaked out.
No, couldn't do that. We knew what to do when we find it. Because 9 times out of 10, it would be, say, in a rubber seal or something.
Right. Actually, I read a report, a declassified report. Is it Roger Rohrbacher?
Probably.
Or Tom Clement. I forget which one wrote it. About when they resealed all the process tubes, put new, they caulked it. Put silicone caulk in order to...
We tried everything.
Yeah.
Radiation does not like anything, I think.
As far as wearing it out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, it just, rubber just gets like a rock and breaks.
And it's hot and cold and hot and cold.
That's right.
And everything else. Yeah. Was the helium radioactive? Would it have been radioactive when it came out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, later on, you know, we went to carbon dioxide. But, see, that was 115. Have you heard of 115?
The building?
Yeah.
Okay, is that where they process the gas?
That's right.
Okay.
But after a while, they just shut that down. We didn't use it anymore.
What'd they use?
Well, we just didn't get any leaks, and you kept it in there, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But at first, it was just a big job keeping it.
But they didn't know, see? People forget what a great job DuPont did. All the things they figured out. They figured out things that might happen. That was 115. That's why we had it. Turned out we didn't need it. But if we had needed it, there it was.
Okay.
Good.
Do you remember, you loaded up a certain number of tubes dry?
Yeah, dry critical and wet critical.
Okay.
Dry critical was the first indication you got of activity with no water in the tubes. And when you ran water, then you had to get another critical.
Right. So when you say critical, you literally mean it was a self-sustained ongoing chain reaction?
At that point at which it was self-sustained,
that's right. And here's a general question I have. How come it went dry critical with not that many tubes, right? A few hundred?
That's, I forgot, it was less,
it was
Jane. I don't think it was half a reactor.
Okay. Why did they make the reactors? Do you know if the size of the reactor was very much bigger than it had to be just to maintain a critical...
You mean the number of tubes and the spacing?
Yeah, no, what dry critical with just a few hundred?
Yeah.
And what critical with a few hundred more?
The water would absorb neutrons. It wouldn't get to the slugs to activate them.
So when you're making a reactor, you have to make it a minimum size to get any chain reaction going.
That minimum size, that was the big thing when the reactor quit on us.
Because all of a sudden it was too small in a sense. That's what they found out later.
Didn't have enough metal in it. It wasn't a question of the size.
Right, right, right. It was
a question of the uranium in the tubes.
So when they designed the reactor, they said, this is not only minimum size, it's a little bigger than minimum size. Because that's obviously you're going to make it a little bit bigger than necessary.
Right.
With the xenon poisoning, they found out that, it's actually too small. All of a sudden, not enough metal.
Yeah.
So they went and filled out the rest of the tubes.
Yeah, and then Fermi and Compton and the man and the wife. Gee, I didn't think of
Marshall.
Marshall.
Yeah.
He was a great guy.
Marshall. Yeah.
They figured that out overnight. I was on 4 to 12, and we were shut down. They shut down the latter part of day shift. And they came in the next day, and we've argued about this. I say that we put 4 more slugs in each tube.
By taking out spacers or something?
Taking out spacers.
Okay. What about filling up the rest of the tubes?
No.
Or were they already filled?
No. No, no. The periphery was never filled. You know, the corners.
Oh, really? Said in your interview that, as I remember it, they added more fuel, 50 more inches of slugs.
How much did they say then?
50 more inches of slugs.
Well, now that's about, well, I think that's a little high, but it
was. Yeah. But you're thinking that those corner tubes were never, ever filled.
Well, if you had something, an experiment, if you
right.
Would, that you wanted to do. You didn't want it to get the full reactor, but you wanted to get some radiation. You could do that. But even then, you wouldn't put it way out the corner. I don't know what it would get out there.
But when they said that there was 2,004 tubes,
that's right.
That includes the whole thing.
That's correct.
Okay. So, but the only ones that actually worked were 1,900 or whatever it might
See,
be.
See, I think that's a 46 by 46 to get the something like 2004, something like that, or
okay.
You know.
Okay. That's 2116.
Yeah. I don't know. 2116?
Yeah.
But Gene, I'm forgetting that. 2004 is right.
Uh-huh.
I was just trying to remember how the tubes were numbered and so on, you know. See, I left 100 areas in 1965 and went back to 200 areas.
Okay.
So
this is not, your life does not depend on the answers,
okay.
Right? We're talking to other people, we're looking at other places,
yeah.
And the stuff you give is great to point me in the right direction,
okay.
And to help fill out stuff that we're not going to get elsewhere, certainly.
Some things I remember, that I can remember that the 46 was one of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big K fiasco, 4639. I remember that perfectly.
What was that?
That's the only time we ever melted the slug down and melted the tube down. We had to replace the sections of graphite.
That was a K?
Yeah.
Oh. That was later on then.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. K's were 1952, as I remember.
How did you melt? You melted the whole tube or just one slug?
Well, several slugs.
Any quickly, can you tell me, for my own lay person's knowledge, what it took to do that?
Well, first of all, you had to design the cutter that would go in. You had to cut around the graphite, miss those tubes.
Wow.
And then you had to get rid of those down into the water, and then you had to replace the graphite. You had to build that section back up with tubes and everything.
The shielding and the whole thing? Did you, from the front face in, you cut through?
Cut from the rear face in, as okay. I remember.
Oh, because it was
there again. I didn't get over there right
yeah.
after doing that.
Yeah.
They didn't want anybody around.
So what was it that melted down the slug?
What are they, in the, a rubber gasket was left in the nozzle of this tube. So it got no water.
Oh, it was dry.
This was right on the startup.
And, but didn't their thermometer tell them that at the other end, you know?
Well, it did, but by then it was too late.
So it's like the oil light on the car.
That's
it's
right.
Like, hey, you just ran out of oil 5 minutes
yeah.
ago. Yeah.
And the oil light on a car says you're probably around 200-300 degrees. That said you're around 1,000 or more.
Yeah. Wow. But it was local to that one tube, though, when they went to fix it.
Yeah, but you couldn't cut out one.
Yeah.
I forget how big a piece it was to cut out.
Okay. Wow.
Because you couldn't take a chance on the other tubes being overheated and damaged, too.
Huh.
As I recall, it was several feet square.
And I guess, was that with fresh fuel, so it wasn't highly
yeah,
overheated?
Yeah, it was a startup.
Yeah.
See, that's why it didn't happen right away. You had to get the slug hot enough and get the neutrons going.
Yeah.
When you first got to know it was too late. Now, I can tell you, a guy can tell you how they did that graphite, because he's a friend of mine and he's still in Kennewick.
For how they cut it out and
yeah.
did the whole process?
Yeah.
That might be interesting. One of the things we're talking about is some of the problems that came along that had to be overcome.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the security on that would be.
Basically, probably none at all, unless there's like, what do you call it, they'd rather not have it talked about, not for security, but just because we would rather leave that story.
You know, nobody wants egg on their face.
But on the other hand, that was a K reactor. It's an interesting thing that points out what kind of things they had to do, whether
yeah.
it relates enough or not, I'll have to think
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
But there was plenty of stuff at B, I think, also, that kept
well,
people going.
Yeah, there were. There was a lot of young guys learning their job. A lot of pressure. And,
yeah.
And sometimes they did things they shouldn't have done. Well, I'll never repeat the name, but one of the guys was in the control room, and he got behind. You know, you had a certain number of hours that otherwise you had to shut down a long time.
Oh, the quickie,
right.
yeah, shut
the quickie
down.
Startup.
Yeah.
And he got behind, and he was approaching the deadline.
Oh, for getting restarted.
And he put the control rods in the startup position and pulled all the verticals.
Boom! Oh, as opposed to following the book and...
That's right. Pull the verticals, and then you slowly pull the horizontal control rods. But he did it the other way around.
And the reactor didn't go hotter than it was supposed to.
Oh hell! We don't know how far it went. That chart, the red line went straight up and was off the damn chart. I don't know what.
No,
we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah.
It wasn't my shift.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they did.
But that's the kind of thing that could happen any time if an operator just didn't think about it or was in a hurry or whatever.
Oh, that's right.
Now, did he know that was not...
Oh, yeah.
You were trained...
He was taking a chance. He didn't want to have to explain why he was late.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true in any job in the world, and especially in defense
with
a very expensive product.
DuPont. Boy, I'll tell you, get caught in a non-safety thing, and you might find yourself being a clerk in the office.
Okay. And this was post DuPont?
This was
after?
Pre DuPont. No, this was DuPont.
DuPont. Okay.
Yeah, because it was. Well, wait a minute. No, because, see, DuPont was still here when I left to go to rocket powder. When I came back, I missed the GE.
The transition? Oh, okay.
By 1 month.
Okay.
Or I'd had all my service. It would have made a lot of difference.
What do you mean you missed GE?
Because, see, they pulled out, and who came in after? Oh, DuPont pulled out, and GE came in.
Right. So if you had gotten back before DuPont left.
Then I'd had all my service.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Would have made a lot of difference.
Could you give me a quick rundown on what it took to start up the reactor? You know, let's say you're done with your fuel recharging, you're all set to go, all the rods are totally in, right?
Well, you've checked all the instrumentation. You know that when you see a reading that's what it is, you know, everything is operable. The water pressure is up.
You turned it back up again. Yeah, everything's shut up tight, water's back on,
that's
running
right
through.
Then you pull the VSRs.
Quickly? No problem.
Yeah, you can
doing
pull
that.
As a matter of fact, in the beginning, we pulled them in banks. As I recall, there were five banks. 39, let's see how that works. 39 rods. And there's five banks. And in the beginning, we would pull them one bank at a time.
Just instead of taking the chance,
right.
You didn't know what might happen.
And it didn't take that much time, you know. Pull them, look at the galvanometer. You're familiar with the term galvanometer. Look at the galvanometer, make sure the bubble wasn't moving, pull another one, and so on.
How fast would each one go up in a matter of 10 seconds?
As long as the galvanometer wasn't moving and none of the instruments, you know, on the startup. Now, we'd have everybody in the control room looking at, one guy would be looking at this chart, one guy would be looking at the panelets and so on. This is in the beginning now, Gene, you know. Later on, we just had our two guys in there and then the chief operator.
It's like airplanes today. You look up front and there's nobody there, one or two guys. Wait a minute.
Okay, then you got the VSRs moved. Then the biophysicist has given you a control rod withdrawal scheme.
And is that going to be different every time?
If you change the loading of the metal, yes, it would.
Where there's, more new
tools. But not a great deal, you know, you didn't want to pull the rod in the hottest, what you thought would be the hottest spot first. And the physicists wouldn't have a pretty good idea where that was.
Okay,
then you slowly then start pulling the control rods to the...
All at once?
No, one at a time? That's right.
Okay.
On the periphery, you could pull a whole rod. But when you start getting into the center, you pull maybe 10, 20 inches a rod.
And watch the gauges.
Critical, well then you hold that rod position. You might have to, as you go along right then on that start, you might have to reinsert a part of a rod, not a whole thing, but a part of a rod.
Okay. And that's just trying to maintain that critical balance.
Later on, we put in what they call pile period meters. And that, then, you could watch that. But we didn't have pile period meters. We had to get the pile periods mentally as we watched things go.
And the period is not literally doubling, but it's something similar to that. It's the period of time it takes to reach the next...
Well, that's the old KE factor, you know. It's as long as it's a little over one.
Right. So the period... Okay.
The period is the amount of time that the reactor would double.
And is it doubling in number of neutrons or?
Doubling in, well, yes it is, but it's actually you're watching megawatts or.
So if you literally just monitored the temperature and had a gauge that would go up quickly, you could literally see it that way.
Yeah, and but that was the galvanometer.
Yeah, okay.
It was pretty sensitive, too.
And how many times would it double to get up to operating temperature or operating power? How many periods are in there?
You were limited to, say, 10, 20 megawatts raised per time limit.
I've read something like that, okay. Not per minute or 2 minutes or... hours or minutes?
Oh, no. It was less time than that.
Okay.
But, you know, you felt your way. You didn't want to go too fast, but you had to do 10 megawatts. And if that 10, 20 megawatts, once you got closer to the full rod configuration that you want for operating, the less time you took. The more you were careful with it. Look, how am I saying? I'm not saying that very well.
As you got closer to the right point, you slowed down.
Approached
it carefully.
In other words, the pile physicist might say something like 10 megawatts per 10 minutes until you get to 200 or something like that.
Okay.
They wrote up a pretty good scheme for startup.
This was still with unenriched fuel, right, for many years?
Yeah, well, enriched fuel didn't come along until pretty late in the game. I think I would say something like the early 50s.
So did they ever load any into B, do you think? Would it have been designed to take enriched fuel?
Well, I think they could. But the first, as I remember, the first reactor that got enriched fuel was H.
Okay.
And that was 1952, see? And we didn't...
Is that all they used, do you think? Or
couldn't do that. We couldn't control that.
What do you mean? We couldn't control...
The enriched fuel. We had to have enriched fuel in with normal uranium.
Otherwise, it'd be too much.
I think
or you'd need a smaller reactor.
I don't know the answer to that. We were very careful with, they were hot.
And you, yeah. And they weren't like pure U-235.
No.
Minor percentage.
3 or 4%,
yeah.
I think it was.
It made all that difference.
Yeah.
Somewhere I read in a book that there was like 6 or 8 different strengths that they made over the many years.
I suspect.
All of which were very minor, fractions.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, on a nuclear submarine, I don't know if you know this or not, but if you want to make a tiny reactor, you'd want to use as enriched of a fuel as possible?
I don't know.
You'd have to be real careful about pulling all the rods out, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
But it seems like that would be one way to make it smaller and smaller and smaller, I presume.
Well, you know, it don't take many megawatts to make steam.
Yeah.
And it's the pressure of the steam that's important. As I remember, I think that's right, not being a submariner.
Yeah. Because I was actually, when you had mentioned earlier about pulling the rods out too fast, I sort of thought that, like Fermi's pile, it was so barely there at all.
Oh, yeah.
That it wasn't going to flash.
Oh, yes, they had the rod on a rope.
And they had to watch slowly as it went up.
Well, they knew even less than we did, you know.
But B was efficient enough that if you pulled the rods out too fast, it would go wherever it wanted right away.
Well, this incident tells you it was at F, which is the same as a B.
It was at F, yeah. But that's amazing. I mean, they actually had the design down pretty well, I guess.
Oh, great. Great.
One more thing I wanted to ask that I read in your interview before. Fuel failures, they didn't happen early on, evidently.
Oh, we didn't run into high enough exposure rate. You know, I think in the beginning, Gene, we ran 200 megawatt days per ton. And when we got finally to, we were up there big. And that's when we start getting the... I really don't know, but it seems to me like we ran as much as 1,000 megawatt days per ton.
So it's not that they were trying to cook it faster by raising the heat up. It was that they wanted it more enriched, more plutonium in it. They ended up with more plutonium per pound.
Yeah.
In the same amount of time.
In the number of times. That's right.
So 200 megawatt days per ton in the beginning...
Which was our limit, you know.
Was that as 200?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and later on you thought it went how high?
It went up to 3,100.
Okay. Per ton.
Oh, yeah, okay, excuse me.
Per, not total output of the reactor.
I'm sorry, I was saying 3,100 megawatts.
Right.
We ran those reactors. And that's when we started getting the leakers and all.
Yeah. It was just because evidently the design they had was about right.
Yeah.
For the initial 250, well, it ran pretty darn well.
But you know, if you wanted plutonium for a bomb, you...
So did they end up enriching it longer later on? Was the content...
Oh, yes. We ran to more megawatt days per ton, longer exposure.
So which created... They had more plutonium at the end of the process.
You shut down for loading just about once a month.
Yeah.
All right, now when you're running at 3,000 megawatts in a month, you'll get one hell of a... But there again, remember, the maximum exposure is where that hottest slug is.
Right.
And around the outside, we didn't push those every month.
They were pushed every year, but not...
According to the physicists said they had gotten in that exposure, in that number of days.
Right. So I could probably find out from somebody how much plutonium they were getting out of the fuel running it at those higher levels. They must be getting two or three times as much out.
Well, oh yes, yes, it was a greater percentage of plutonium. See, that's what they pushed them. We were pushed, you know.
Yeah. Well, now today we have so much left over, you know.
Laying around,
we did such
know
a good job
with it.
Yeah. It was one of those things that nobody, I think, ever understood. The politicians never understood how much we actually needed.
No.
But we better get a damn...
Well, I think... Let's see. Can I remember? When we first started out, I think somebody told me that, you needed 21 pounds of plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand, at the end, you only needed 7.
Oh. I know that they can make them much, much smaller
these
days.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, there again, that's top secret stuff, you know.
Yeah. And, well, part of the making it smaller is also how you ignite it. I mean, the device that actually sets it off. But no, I've heard that suitcase-sized bombs are by no means out of the question anymore.
That's what I understand.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah. No, it is. Especially since we never worry about the Soviet Union having suitcase-sized bombs, but today with terrorists and small countries, it's the kind of thing that you don't want to have to start thinking about. So now we have, 20,000 pounds? No, we must have more than 20,000 warheads.
We've got 20,000 warheads.
Yeah.
I think that's
each of which is 20-30 pounds of plutonium. That's quite a bit. And we don't know what to do with it. That's the funny part. It happened very quickly.
Well, we'd know what to do with it if we could run uranium to the plutonium reactor.
Could you run a pure plutonium reactor?
PRTR at Patel.
That was... Yeah? But they would most likely mix it with natural uranium.
I think they'd mix some in there.
Did the reactor get... after a month of running a reactor with the same fuel, did you pull the rods farther and farther out because it got less and less reactive?
No, we controlled it at whatever megawatts we wanted.
But to hold it there, as time went by, did you have to pull them out in order to...
No.
Make,
uh-uh.
It didn't lose some of its reactivity?
No, it didn't.
We weren't using up a lot of the fuel that was in there.
No, that's right.
Okay.
That's the point.
Yeah, because for all that power coming out of it, you were only taking a tiny fraction
that's
of what
right.
was in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, well, you know, that's why the waste tanks at the 200 area are full of depleted uranium.
They didn't take it out, the separations process, I really haven't looked into that much. They end up with plutonium here in a little bucket. What'd they do with all the uranium?
It goes out in the solutions. Because when you're separating everything but the plutonium.
Yeah.
See, and in each stage, when you go down the canyon, that goes out to the waste tank. You got no place else to put it.
Why didn't they separate out the uranium and keep it? Not worth it?
Well,
too much trouble. Too much.
What would you do with that hot uranium?
Put it back in. Oh. You couldn't handle it.
No.
not for many, many years.
For many, many years. Well, the waste tanks right now are...
So in the processing, the normal thing was to pipe it out to a tank and say, we're done with it?
That's right.
Yeah. That was tough because they knew that it was going to have to sit there for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't sure it was going to sit there forever.
Well, they had the right idea, though, that they said, we'll figure it out later on.
Well, we don't have time, anyhow.
Yeah.
You know.
Or the technology.
That's right.
But now we
do. Well, no, we could have reworked it and got... Now, depleted uranium is used on the tanks as shielding.
Oh, right. And they use it in bullets, too.
That's right.
For shooting at tanks.
That's right.
But that's... Is that depleted reactor uranium?
No, because we never did that here. You know, everything was so compartmentalized. Some of those things we just didn't know, and you better and you didn't ask either, you know.
No, it's... It was definitely a different time and a different way. And it seems like the people I've talked to today say most of it is no longer classified.
I think that's right.
And they won't give a blanket one by any means, but they generally say there's only a few things we don't want people talking
well,
about.
Well, you know, when you get around to it, the anti-nukes and the environmentalists, they forced a lot of the declassification of documents.
Yeah.
And I suppose there were still semi. I don't see it anymore. I've never gone down to the library to look at what was declassified.
Mm-hmm. It was. I think all the good stuff was already out in the world anyway.
It got out. Oh, there's always talking.
And it's just science. There's nothing magic about it. Any stupid scientist anywhere on Earth could have sat down and given enough help and enough money and enough time.
Look at it now. They say that a lot of people can make a bomb themselves.
Yeah. Well, India and Pakistan now have theirs, and they worked hard to do it.
Don't forget, we had Indians over here and all of that.
Yeah. It was going on for years and years. Well, tell you what. How about if we, call it a day, and if I have some questions for you later on, I could give you a telephone call.
You're calling it. Yeah.
Great. I appreciate that.
Sure.
It's.
I'm a retired old man, you know.
Well, I don't know. Somehow retired people always have a lot going on, or they don't want to get involved in too much stuff.
That's right.
So there's that too.
Yeah.
Call
any time.
Okay.
We can always get together somewhere.
There might be a point in several weeks or month when we're talking about actual operations at the reactor. Not the construction, but the actual operations. And this business about what it took to do a startup and some of the instruments that were looked at and the problems that came up. Might ask you about that.
Yeah.
Because that's... you can read about what went into the graphite, how much concrete they used, and what the dimensions were, but the actual steps involved on a normal daily routine, you don't necessarily read about.
No.
So that might be good.
Okay.
I certainly appreciate it.
Whatever I remember is that time.
Yeah, well, I know. That's always the hard part, I think.
But now, graphite, this friend of mine in Kennewick, when he was here, he was in the 2101 building machining graphite.
Oh.
And and he and I have watched a lot of layups of graphite, and we watched DR. That was interesting. He and I were on that following it, and we had a GE construction man that was kind of wild, and we knew there was something wrong with it was going on, because they were hiding it from us, and finally. When we got just about to the top of the reactor layup of the graphite, we found out they were half inch high. And we made,
you just shave off the top half inch, right?
Oh no. Made them take it down.
Really? Were the holes lining up for the process tubes?
Well, they'd be like this.
So you haven't put any tubes in yet. You didn't do it as you went up. You built the whole graphite, and then you hoped that the tubes would go right in.
Yeah, that's right.
And these were getting off.
And he didn't hide it, and we finally got a hold of DuPont. design man came out and helped us, and we forced him to give us the figures. And old McEwen, all right, take it down.
Wow.
He was a great guy. He's a guy. I don't know, were you here when Bill Johnson was manager?
No.
Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Oh, he was a pompous ass. But, and I was working down the 760 building one time. This McEwen was out here on loan from DuPont. He was top notch. And I was happened to be going in with Mac one day into the building, and a little after 8, I don't remember what it was. I had been somewhere at the running, but Mac was just getting there. But he'd been out to the plant till 9, 10 o'clock, you know. And Johnson stopped and said, "Well, Mac, you know," he says, "we around here, we start at 8 o'clock. And McEwen, he wouldn't take that time." He says, "Well, tell you, Scott, well, I'll tell you, Bill," he says, "it ain't so much when you get here that counts as what you do after you get here." And that turned around, walked away from
him. Well, sounds like the same as everywhere else in the world,
yeah,
right, as far as jobs go.
Yeah, he was, he was great.
Yeah. We picked up a videotape of some old movies, 16mm movies they shot during construction of Hanford.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only construction movies I've seen. It's like a half hour with subtitles, no sound, but a subtitle that says, you know, laying the graphite, and then there's like a minute of guys laying graphite.
Yeah.
And
if you want to show those sometimes, I'll sit with you and tell you what's going on.
If you're interested, before then, I have to go pick it up. We're going to be showing it next week at our meeting, if you feel like going to another B-reactor meeting next Monday, a week from today.
Joe always called me. Joe Hedges always called
Okay. Well, I'll remind him this time that we're going to be showing the video.
Yeah, okay.
It's like a half hour long. It's about the right length of time. And they show also the 200 area, the processing separations building. I'd never seen good close-ups of the tanks with all the stuff in it. It was great. All the plumbing coming in.
Yeah.
I was impressed. But it's the only one I've seen.
Yeah.
I thought there'd be hours and hours and hours of movies taken. Do you remember people coming around photographing and movieing, making movies?
Well, yeah, because they had to be cleared, and we generally escorted them.
Well, but during construction, I mean, weren't there lots and lots of documentation being made?
No.
Yeah.
No.
See, these days they would, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And the contractors' lawyers would insist on it, probably, that they have video.
Oh, I think so.
But maybe
cost quality assurance definitely would.
Yeah, but back then it was too much of a hurry, and it wasn't normal maybe at that point to take movies.
You know, the construction people, they didn't know anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It was very interesting because they always would want to talk to us, you know, and say, "Well, I know what's going on." And some of the ideas they had were amazing. And of course, we couldn't say anything yes or no.
Yeah. And you knew basically the whole process, right?
Well, I had everything explained to me in the University of Chicago, you know.
Yeah. Because you had the separations end and everything else.
Well, I was supervising towards the end of the SemaWorks, and I was getting all the runs that Alba and Seaborg wanted, and,
mm-hmm.
and putting them down.
All right. Yeah, you were lucky to have seen the whole process.
Oh, yeah, I was very lucky, yeah.
But you've lived here ever since he came out?
Well,
except for that short period?
See, then after, in 1945, they said that the construction of the B, D, and F was just about done. B was started, F was, D was started, and F was...